Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the political upheaval in Turkey, where massive demonstrations have taken place in response to a brutal government crackdown on environmental protesters. Asla Bali, a professor at the UCLA School of Law, who is in Istanbul, joins us for an update on the protests and what this means in terms of Turkey's role in the opposition to the Assad regime in Syria. Then we will get another analysis on protests against the Islamist government of Prime Minister Erdogan from Sona Chapte, who is a regular columnist for Hurriyet Daily News, who writes extensively on U.S.-Turkish relations and Turkish domestic policy. He joins us to discuss what looks like a widening religious secular divide in a country long dominated by the military that has recently seen unprecedented growth and prosperity and an emerging middle class. Then finally, we will speak with Michael Clare, a five-college professor of peace and world security studies, about the arms pouring into Syria from Russia and whether there will be a renewed Cold War-like arms race in the region with Russia arming Assad and the U.S. arming Israel. Michael Clare has an article at the Huffington Post, The Cold War Redux. And joining us now from Istanbul, Turkey, is Asla Bali, who's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. And she has a forthcoming book called The Legality Legitimacy Debate in the Context of Non-Proliferation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asla Bali.
Hi.
Tell us about this spontaneous demonstration that took place in response to a police crackdown on environmental protesters who are protesting trees being cut down in a park to accommodate a new shopping mall. My understanding is that this was a massive demonstration that was completely spontaneous, and people showed up in the thousands at 3 a.m. Is that right?
Well, this has been now going on for quite a number of days. We're actually in the sixth day today of the protests. On the first day, the numbers of protesters were probably under 100, so 50 to 75 people who were there, as you say, environmentalists who were there protesting the bulldozing of trees in a historic park in Taksim Square, which is the most important central square in Istanbul. It's sort of the Tahrir Square, if you want, of Istanbul, which is the largest city in Turkey, although not the capital, but the capital has also seen major protests, which is Ankara. Those protesters were met with a violent crackdown by the police, and some of the images, which were distributed very rapidly over social media, of the kind of brutality that those protesters met with led to, as you say, spontaneous acts of solidarity, people flooding to the square. And so by the third and fourth days of the protest, you had, as you say, thousands, and indeed on Friday and into Saturday, tens of thousands. Some organizers have said that the number was over 100,000, possibly as many as 200,000 protesters in the square yesterday. Yesterday, which was Saturday here, up to about 4 p.m, there were very serious, violent police repression in the square involving the excessive use of tear gas, pepper spray, water cannon, and barricades all over to try to prevent people from being able to access the square. Many parts of traffic all around the city were closed off. There was a major opposition rally that had been planned, a party meeting, for 4 p.m. on Saturday. The opposition party, which is called the Cumhuriyet Halk Partisi, the Republican People's Party, had scheduled this meeting far in advance, not related in any way to the protest, but the coincidence of that planned rally with the events that were taking place in Taksim Square meant that it took on increased significance. The party leader, the head of the opposition, traveled to Istanbul for that meeting, and it was widely anticipated the meeting would be extremely large. The meeting was on the Asian side of the city, in a part of the city called Kadıköy. The party opposition leader, particularly in response to a set of provocative statements from the prime minister, decided to cancel that meeting and call upon all of his party members who had planned to attend the meeting to continue to Taksim Square, to go to relocate themselves to the square where the protests were taking place, at which point the government was faced with a choice. Are they going to continue the incredible crackdown that had seen really gales of tear gas and pepper spray overtake large parts of the European side of the city, areas where tourists are located, major luxury hotels and so forth? Were they going to redouble the violence, or were they going to step back? And the decision was taken to pull the police back from the center of the square. There were still numbers of clashes for hours thereafter, and also clashes at the major port that connects the Asian side to the European side, Beşiktaş, where you had hundreds and thousands of protesters arriving in order to join. The protesters already in Taksim Square, you had incidents there continuing late into the night last night. But nonetheless, the police withdrew from the square around 4 p.m. Yesterday. And since then, the mood has turned in turns violent at some point. There were much more militant protesters who came out and engaged in clashes with the police that were now in different positions outside of the square. And that led to a series of acts of violence, which some of which has been portrayed by the government to suggest that the entire movement is somehow a set of violent looters, which is completely false. These were marginal incidents at the, you know, very isolated, but there were, you know, cars burned, buses and trucks overturned, shop windows broken, stones thrown, and so forth at different times last night. Today has been much calmer. Again, the police presence has not as yet returned to Taksim, although there's a chance that that might happen later tonight. It's now 9 p.m. in Istanbul. It could happen later. It could happen overnight. Part of what really drove the anger of the protesters was a 5 a.m. raid that occurred Thursday night, Friday morning. For those protesters who had camped out in the square, they met with severe violence from the police at 5 a.m. when everybody was asleep, and that really fueled the fire on Friday and Saturday. And it's not beyond the possibility, beyond the pale for this government to engage in something similar tonight. So it's not known yet, but there are thousands of people that have streamed to Taksim over the course of today. And it's at this point peaceful, celebratory. People are very happy with what they feel has been a victory against the incredible police brutality that they faced earlier on in the protests. And they want to show strength in numbers to prevent the police from coming to reoccupy the square. Of course, in the meantime, the source of the protests and the things that people are protesting have grown well beyond the original question of bulldozing of trees. But really, even the bulldozing of trees question was not simply an environmentalist question. The sense is that this government is essentially committed to a neoliberal, business-oriented set of policies that raise multiple historic sites and important districts in Turkey to make way for shopping malls and other major business projects, many of which are ill-conceived, exhibit very poor urban planning, and so forth. And so Istanbul in particular, where there had already been numbers of protests over the past course of last year for other instances in which the government had chosen to demolish historically significant or places that are important from the perspective of the public and the public arena to make way for shopping malls, this was just deemed the last straw. So that's what set off these protests. And now it's a much wider coalition of people that are really simply angry with the way in which the government is conducting itself and adopting policies in a kind of what is perceived as an authoritarian manner, and adopting policies without sufficient public consultation, and policies that really run against the grain of what many different urban dwellers, in particular in Turkey, think would be the appropriate direction that should be taken. So between things like restrictions on alcohol sales, public remonstration of individuals for example, kissing in public, which was deemed to be some kind of a morality question, public morality question, to the demolition of various historic sites. There's just an accumulation of resentment and anger over various initiatives undertaken by this government. And in the background of all of this are a number of much broader issues: Kurdish reconciliation, the government's foreign policy towards Syria, its overall economic policies and wealth inequality in Turkey, its treatment of urban spaces, and the possibility that this particular prime minister is pursuing a constitutional reform project to put in place in Turkey a more presidential system with an eye himself to becoming president, which many think of as the final power grab. And they simply do not want to see the current prime minister install himself as some kind of Chavez-style figure in Turkey.
And again, I'm speaking with Asla Bali, who is in Istanbul, Turkey. She is a professor at the UCLA School of Law. And the response from Prime Minister Erdogan has been arrogant and dismissive. He said, they are putting on airs saying we massacre trees. I ask in the name of God, Erdogan is a dictator. If you are the kind of person who can call someone who serves their people a dictator, then I have no words for you. So how much is this prime minister driven by his own religious righteousness?
I think that it would be a mistake to understand what's happening right now as a secularist-Islamist divide. I understand that that might be the framing that some have pursued. I think that's an oversimplification and also basically misunderstands much of what's happening in the square. What's interesting about the people who've come out, not only are they of all ages and largely a middle-class crowd, of course, with university students and other kinds of organized union and so forth also supporting, but you have a huge outpouring of the general public. You also have women in headscarves. You have people who are religiously conservative who are simply fed up with the tone, as you say, the arrogance and dismissiveness of the government. So this is really not about religious secular divide. This is about a broader set of underlying policy questions that cut across that divide. It is very much a referendum on this prime minister. He's an extremely popular politician in Turkey. He's deemed a very charismatic leader by many. He certainly has gone from victory to victory in the elections in which the party has run as a whole, including the most recent elections in 2011 when they won a near outright majority, which he invokes all the time, saying, you know, I was able to come to power through the ballot box. These demonstrators don't have any right to express themselves other than by the ballot box. The difficulty is that the opposition in Turkey is splintered and the vote gets fragmented among different opposition strains. And it is true that the political party that the prime minister comes from is very likely to be successful in the next round of elections as well. But this is more of a personal referendum on him and the style of his leadership and the way in which he personally has been governing in a quite authoritarian manner. So it's not that he's come to power as a dictator. It's true that he's come to power through the electoral box, but his personal style is extremely off-putting, and particularly his repeated invocation of his electoral victory, which, while a very serious and strong showing of support, was not even 50%. We have a multi-party system, so when you have many parties competing, getting anywhere near 50% is a major electoral victory, but it still doesn't represent even a complete majority, a simple majority of the country, let alone the many others who he's alienating. And also he's alienated many of his own base with the tone he's taken, with the high-handedness of the policy announcement, with no consultation from one day to the next. You have no idea what new initiative the government is going to announce. We're going to raise this public square. We're going to destroy this historic monument. We're going to make way for this shopping mall or this major futurist project. I mean, they've named dozens of such projects in the last year. Only 5 days ago, he was inaugurating the opening of the third bridge to cross the Bosphorus, which is going to have very serious environmental consequences and urban consequences for the city. And they've chosen to name that bridge, furthermore, for a historic Ottoman figure, a sultan who is best known, or well known at least, for the fact that he had massacred thousands of Aydınlı people who are from a religious minority in Turkey, a heterodox Muslim group who themselves feel very embattled at the moment. And so this announcement, the announcement of a major new airport that's going to be built in Istanbul, I mean, he's involved in a set of infrastructure projects that he plans to stamp with his name, essentially, as this is the accomplishment of this party. And no one stands in the way, or nobody opposes the need to for urban planning, for new projects, for infrastructure to support the size of the population. But the high-handed methods, the heavy-handedness of the response to opposition, all of this has produced a very serious front that is calling for the resignation of the prime minister. The likelihood of accomplishing that, I think, is very low, but he himself, the prime minister, albeit in a very arrogant manner, has been forced to acknowledge first the unpopularity of this project to destroy the Taksim Gezi Park, the excursion park in Taksim. A court, in any case, has issued what amounts to a temporary restraining order, preventing them from going forward with the project. He's appealing that, but he's had to acknowledge that there's opposition. He's also had to acknowledge that mistakes have been made in the decisions by the Minister of the Interior and the head of security, who have authorized this incredible police crackdown and the pulling back of the police as a result, and the symbolism of the court victory are all being celebrated today by the protesters as victory in their battle to create a more accountable government and greater accountability around these policy initiatives.
Well, just in closing, Asabali, I'm sure that this may well be the beginning of galvanizing an opposition that you say is split. But I'm curious to know what miscalculations Erdogan made in foreign policy, because it seems like he and Hillary Clinton and others thought that the Assad regime would fall. And, of course, Erdogan himself was very close to Assad in Syria. I believe the families got together for vacations and holidays, etc. And I'm also curious to know why, after the bombing that killed so many people inside of Turkey, which clearly came from Syria, why there was such a muted response or no response whatsoever from Turkey and something of a press blackout.
Yes, and indeed the media actually, I mean, I will turn to a foreign policy question, but one big sub-story of this overall set of protests is the absolute gag order and muzzle that this government has placed on the media and the crackdown on independent journalism. As you probably know, Turkey now has a dubious distinction of having imprisoned the largest proportion of journalists of any country in the world, with both China and Iran behind Turkey in this respect. And this has been a hallmark of this government. You would not have been able to know that these protests were taking place, let alone the scale of the protests, by watching any number of Turkish news stations, which were showing documentaries about penguins and dolphins and far-flung human interest stories from Mongolia, instead of covering what was actually happening in the country yesterday in particular. In fact, there's a movement and there's a hashtag that's trending on Twitter to boycott CNN Turk, the CNN affiliate in Turkey, because it had failed to give the coverage that even CNN International was prepared to give. And this is a consequence of the muzzle that the government has placed on the media, which also applies, as you say, to the deaths of the 52 Turkish citizens in Reyhan as a result of bombings associated with the Syria policy. One difficulty about that bombing is it's actually difficult to know who specifically to attribute the bombing to. It's not clear that it was, in fact, pro-government forces. It may as much have been opposition forces or Islamist forces or others related to Turkey's Syria policy seeking to galvanize a stronger response from Turkey. And I think part of the reason why you haven't seen that stronger response is confusion as to the motivation for the bombing and whether or not further engagement of Turkey and Syria is prudent at this time or might give way to even greater bombing. There have been some scattered reports, for example, of the discovery of sarin gas canisters in Turkey that may or may not have been brought in by opposition forces that were able to overtake, warehouse facilities, perhaps in parts of Syria, or maybe it's pro-government forces that have brought them in. It's very hard to know, but there's a very large refugee population, Syrian refugee population, that takes various different political positions on the conflict, and Turkey is uncertain how to proceed in responding to acts of violence that may or may not be emanating from different groups in Syria and having effects here in Turkey. That said, there are two sets of miscalculations that this government has made. One has to do with the actual course of events in Syria, and I'm happy to talk about that, but before I turn to that, I think it's what's connected to these protests is the miscalculation of this government as to the appetite of the Turkish public for the foreign policy course that the government has taken. There is very little support and tremendous opposition to the government's degree of involvement in Syria at this stage. Many in Turkey, including people from the base of the government, the people who have voted for the AKP in the past, question why the Turkish government has decided to allow armed opposition groups to be headquartered in Turkey, why we've taken such a strong stance with respect to a civil war in a neighboring country, and what ultimately the Turkish national interest is in this hardline position. Also, there are those who argue that the Turkish government has taken an increasingly sectarian stance and that they themselves don't identify, the Turkish public largely does not identify with the sectarianism being evinced by the government's foreign policy. So there's a lot of criticism and a lot of opposition to the exposure that the Erdogan government has created for Turkey on the Syrian question. He does not have widespread public support on the Syria foreign policy. So that's a domestic miscalculation, quite apart from the possible ramifications of the government's position and belief that Assad would fall for the success of their foreign policy in Syria itself.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today from Istanbul, Turkey. Asla Bale.
I'm delighted to have been with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Asla Bale, who's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. She has a forthcoming book called The Legality Legitimacy Debate in the Context of Non-Proliferation. We're going to take a brief station break and be back getting another opinion on what is happening in Turkey. Yalan, başkası yalan, dünyada ölümden başkası yalan, yalan, başkası yalan.
Christmas.